This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week. On the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR, here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Well, we are back. It has been a while, Doc, and I'm excited that it's been a while. That means the Cardinals had a good season.
Well,
see? I will give up some time for the Cardinals any day of the week.
The rest could have been longer, but 11-5 even wouldn't have been good enough.
But I am glad that we are back, and everyone else got to have a 2013 rap show. Everyone else did. Let's not exclude ourselves. Let's get that done today. We have three very special guests in studio with us. Fernanda Santos, the New York Times Phoenix Bureau Chief. She's actually writing a book about the Granite Mountain Hotshots, going to be released in 2015. Robert Robb is here from the Arizona Republic. Howard Fisher from the Capital Media Services.
Hey, guess what, Mike? You know, what? We got through the entire year of 2013 without repeating a single guest.
Check us out.
That's right. But it's now...
I can get a trophy or something.
It's now 2014 and gave us an opportunity to bring back two of the best. First of all, Howie Fisher, who was just a triple crown winner on the Horizon PBS show, best predictions 3 years in a row.
Well, you do realize that given that particular show, 50% makes you the best.
Yeah.
Shows a little something about making predictions.
Well, set the bar low and you'll never be disappointed.
You can't fall off the floor, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And Fernanda Santos, New York Times, also a repeat guest. And a third guest, Bob Robb, a virgin on the think tank, but certainly not a virgin in Arizona media. I'll go to you first, Bob. Biggest story of the year 2013, Arizona context.
I think certainly the biggest accomplishment of the year was the expansion of Medicaid and Jim Brewer's leadership of it. I was sharply critical of the coup at the legislature by which she accomplished it. I thought that was unnecessary. But if you simply look at what was accomplished over the course of the year, that stands out as the biggie.
It's certainly big, big dollars were at stake.
Yep.
Howie?
Well, a lot of kudos to the governor for being able to engineer it, whether she needed to do that, as Bob suggests, or not, and whether it was necessary. I think what's going to have longer effects is what's going on with CPS. Now, CPS is a perennial issue. I understand that. You know, probably in the, 30-some years I've been covering the legislature, CPS always comes up.
Just in case somebody's been in a hole for the last 6 months, give us a short rundown.
There is a perennial issue about, A, is there enough funding? And then B, that this sort of pendulum that swings back and forth over you err on the side of taking the child from the home no matter what, or you err on the side of keeping the family together and risking that the child will be harmed.
And that's a no-win choice.
That's a no-win choice.
Maybe you find an in-between place, right? And that's, I think, the biggest challenge, not only for them, but every other state's child welfare agency.
It is. But what I think finally got a lot of folks' attention was this screw-up that occurred where all of a sudden 6,500-plus cases were just marked NI, as in not for investigation, and somehow fell through the cracks. And all of a sudden, for a lot of folks for whom CPS was not a prime issue, they recognize we need to focus on this. Now, whether that means creating a whole new agency out of it, whether that means giving Clarence Carter, who's the DES director of the ACTS, or something else, I think that's going to be a prime issue this coming year.
What's your take on why he's survived?
To this point, I think a lot of it is that the governor is under pressure by a lot of Democrats to fire him, and she won't give in while the Democrats are pressuring her. I think Clarence, if we're sitting around this table the same time next year, I think Clarence will have been history for quite some time.
That's the first prediction right there.
That's yours. Fernanda, top story.
Well, I think that I have to agree with both of them. And, it's hard to ignore, even though it's not necessarily a political story per se, but the significance of the Yarnell Hill fire for the state and actually for the country. Because in addition to if you leave... as hard as it is to set aside the deaths of 19 firemen in a fire that should have been and could have been stopped from early on, I think it exposed what years of budget cuts, confusion over policy, different theories and beliefs as to how forests ought to be protected, not just in the state but across the country, really kind of converged into this fire. And everything came together and contributed to the tragedy that happened. The Forestry Division submitted a budget proposal asking for, I believe, twice the amount of money that he got last year. And one of the and that was a budget proposal that was submitted before the latest report from ADOSH, the state version of OSHA, came out that pointed out to flaws in management.
And this is the state Forest Service, rather.
Exactly, the Arizona Forestry Division. In this budget request, they mentioned the fact that they don't have enough people on staff to manage fires. And one of the big problems in this fire was that people who were managing it were overwhelmed. It was clear that things kept moving and changing so fast that people just could not get a handle on this fire. And from there, you see that ultimately at the bottom of it all is a financial and political decision that was made, that and financial political decisions that have been made over and over that created the situation.
But my fear is that we're going to see a Band-Aid approach at the legislature. I think what's going to happen is, for example, you've got Andy Tobin, who's running for Congress, wanting sort of a state set of hotshots. I'm not sure what the heck that accomplishes. You have people who want to throw some additional money at it. Again, if you look at that ADOSH report, you see that the problem was lack of coordination, vacant positions, you know, mm-hmm. nobody watching out for the firefighters, lack of communication. And I'm afraid that this is one of those situations, and you've seen it as a veteran political reporter, where I know we'll just throw some money at it and think
and
we'll
solve it. And it's an election year, right? So that is sort of like the perfect opportunity for people like Andy Tobin and others to come out and mm-hmm. say, you know, same with CPS.
Yeah.
Let's just throw more money into it and we'll solve the problem.
I think what it's going to be, either way, it's going to be a political issue. Anyone running for office is going to use the Yarnell, their solution
yes.
for Yarnell as to win some votes.
Yes.
Are we all
or their solution
there?
To CPS or mm-hmm. their solution
right.
to even education, right? Because we can't forget that the public school system in the state has suffered. A lot of people thought it was their chance to get money now, and who knows what's going to happen.
We are looking back at 2013. We have an all-star cast assembled for you. Fernanda Santos, Bob Robb, and Howie Fisher all looking back at what was Arizona 2013. We're going to get to more of that next right here in the Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are back here on The Think Tank with three journalists who mostly cover Arizona, but we're going to ask them now about their pontifications on things national. Howie, I don't recall you ever having been asked a question about national things.
Well, I try to avoid it. You know, I try to live within the, 200 by 200 mile, Arizona limit.
Well, you're not going to do that now. Biggest national story.
Take that, Howie.
I think the NSA story has to be. I think it's the fallout continues to occur. I think that while people were certainly aware that perhaps post 9/11 that maybe the government was paying closer attention, they had no idea of that when they go on the Facebook page that somebody wanted to know where they were doing. The metadata from the phones, all of that. I think it was just an amazing, amazing story. And whatever you think of Edward Snowden, whether you think he's a hero, whether you think he's a traitor, I think we need to have that discussion in an open society.
And I think a lot of people are still trying to figure out the answer to that question. Fernanda, what about you?
You know, I have to agree, it's pretty hard not to think of the NSA as being the biggest story just because of the different things that you know, the debates that it has sparked. But I also think that Obamacare and the launch of Obamacare is not something to be ignored.
That was the answer I expected at first.
I forget who it was who made this comment, but I thought it was pretty interesting that, you know, some college kids in their college dorm room are able to create something like Facebook, and the federal government cannot figure out how to, you know, launch a system where people can sign up for healthcare online. And I think it's, you know, it says a lot about how things in federal government sometimes are decided and done. And also, it says a lot about the level of expectation that we have for the promises when they are made in a way that's so big and comprehensive and we're going to change the world kind of thing.
That's really the point. If you like what you have in insurance,
you're going to keep it. Right.
And all of a sudden it's, except except for this footnote, except as forbidden by law, blah blah blah.
When you have anything as complicated as that, yes, it's pretty hard to follow through on an broad sweeping promise that has no qualifications.
Well, a lot of people, when they were debating the immigration law, right? Let's not forget that there was a point that there was a Senate-approved 2,000-some-page immigration bill out there. Some legislators were against it, mentioned Obamacare in saying that the problem is that we had to vote on it so fast that we didn't even get a chance to read it carefully until after we voted on it. And I think in some ways I wonder if the president, if the same thing kind of happened to him. He had his advisors looking and shaping things up, and somebody told him, yeah, people will be able to
There was
to
also
their
the
stuff.
Little matter of the fact that he was running for re-election at the time as well.
And
the 2,000-page qualified answer probably didn't go over as well. Robert?
I think certainly in terms of short-term consequence, the rocky rollout of and failed promises of Obamacare was the largest story. I agree that the NSA story is also very large. But long-term, there was something that happened over the course of the year that I think will have deeper ramifications as we move forward. And it is partially within the Obamacare discussion and debate, and that is the assertion of authority by the executive branch to simply ignore or rewrite provisions of statutory law, not changing the administrative rules that implement those, but actually ignoring or effectively rewriting the laws themselves. It's not unprecedented, but it certainly is an extraordinary reach. The Obama administration has done it extensively. And so far, there hasn't been anyone who's figured out a way to effectively challenge that as a violation of the separation of powers. In addition to the instance that Obamacare was used in the immigration debate previously, this also played into the immigration debate. Because many Republican members of the House were saying, how can we accept any assurances that are written into law about border security when the Obama administration has asserted the authority to ignore what's written in law and change it at their whim? So I think long term that may be the biggest story of the year, although we'll have difficulty in trying to fathom its true depths. In the short term.
And when you talk about the true depths, I mean, go even long term. We talk about this might be the same answer this time next year as the biggest stories of the year in 2014. Might even be the same thing. We talk about the NSA and still the fallout from Snowden and then the Obamacare.
And the immigration one, and it's a good point in terms of that the Obama administration has read the INA and said, I can grant deferred action under this broad authority, under prosecutorial discretion.
And actually create a new class, a new immigration class, which goes beyond just deferred action. Deferred action is this particular person in this particular circumstance, we're going to choose not to prosecute. Instead, what the Obama administration did is they created an immigration class for which people apply. I mean, what kind of deferred action? Since when do people apply not to be prosecuted?
And that's got some interesting precedent, because if you can do this for anyone who's brought as a child, is not yet reached the age of 30, meets certain other qualifications,
can you do it for everyone?
And prosecutorial discretion is, in fact, broad, and the courts generally have upheld it. But you're right, Bob. I mean, I don't know how far that can go before all of a sudden you're saying, well, then why have the INA in the first place?
Well, I'll take that really, Robert, as your answer to anticipating my next question, which is perhaps the most underreported story, which is, I think, a harder question. Do you have one of those, Howie?
Well, underreported, I think the Voting Rights Act decision, I think that there are a lot of shoes to drop in that one.
The congressional decision not to renew?
Well, not so much a congressional
decision, Supreme Court decision,
more the Supreme Court decision that on the preclearance. Now, they still left in place the part that says you cannot adversely affect minority voting strength. but you've turned around the burden.
Which has a huge impact. What that means is that when a legislature passes some law alleged to restrict voting rights or change districts, that the presumption is that that's the law and you don't have to go to Washington.
Exactly. And that, I think, is something that we haven't even seen the beginnings of. I think we're going to see it more and more in terms of issues of voter ID. I think we're going to see it in terms of issues of waiting periods, in terms of even Arizona's own laws that are still being challenged, the referendum over, you know, who can collect, you know, ballots, who can register people to vote. And I think that's a sleeper in there.
That kind of goes with the story that I think was the most underreported. And it's at least from a personal standpoint, I wish I had been able to write more about it and that I had been able to read more about it. And that's the changing demographics. That was a big topic of 2012. In Arizona, it is such a deep and profound change that we're seeing. And I almost have a feeling that the state is at this point politically where the people who are in office or running for office understand who are in office and running for re-election or those who are entering, you know, trying to go to higher office, like Doug Ducey, for example, understand that these changes will not be in place, will not affect their election this year, that it will be maybe another 8, 12 years until there's a real impact in terms of how candidates are chosen here. So there is not a great concern to try to bring in this new class of voters, the young Latinos in this state, and be more inclusive. I point to the decision by the governor not to grant the driver's licenses to the people who were given deferred action, which obviously, if you are an 18-year-old and you are not able to get your driver's license, you're not going to vote for a Republican should the time come that you become a citizen of this country, or if you have little brothers and sisters who are citizens and one day get to vote here.
Right. Bob, you do get a turn, I promise, but we're up against a commercial break here, so we're gonna break real quick. We come back, Bob is going to tell us his opinion of the most underreported story. We're also going to get to our panelist predictions for 2014. Thanks for being with us, folks. Mike O'Neill, Mike Russell, you're in the Think Tank, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're back with our panel of journalists. Rob, you were going to tell us what you think the most underreported story of 2013 has been on a national level.
Well, I do believe that the separation of powers issues that we were discussing qualifies, but I would also nominate the Federal Reserve continuing to dig a deeper hole with loose monetary policy, despite little evidence that lower interest rates are the key to stimulating an economic recovery. That has created a huge monetary overload that the Fed is now going to have a very tricky job of trying to unwind over the course of the next several years.
Okay, for a remainder, I want to go a number of quick questions, and you can answer this on the national or on the state level, whatever you think is the most interesting surprise story of 2014.
Yes.
There were something on the agenda in 2014 that we're not talking about that much now. Howie?
I think Arizona redistricting, there are three lawsuits out there. I think that there's a good chance that the courts, in at least one of them, will overturn it, which paves the way, depending on what happens, for redrawing either congressional or legislative lines. We redraw congressional lines. It's not going to be 5-4 Democrats in the next.
May not
election.
Be 5-4 Democrat anyway.
It may
but,
not be 5-4 Democrats.
But they won't have. Yeah.
But I think that redistricting is going to. There's a good chance that one of those three lawsuits is going to take hold.
Fernanda.
I think we're going to see some movement on the SB Section 2B of the SB 1070, the Arizona immigration law. There's been a lot of talk among, you know, civil rights groups.
You mean in the courts?
In the courts, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there is it was a portion of the law that the U.S. Supreme Court didn't touch because it had not taken effect. And it's now in effect. It's been over a year, and I think there's a lot of attention being paid as how it's being executed on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Bob?
Comparable to Howie's answer, there's also several different legal cases challenging various aspects of Arizona's campaign finance law, mm-hmm. including one in which a federal district court judge has threatened to declare all of our campaign finance laws unconstitutionally vague and therefore unenforceable. So it may be that these laws are going to have to be rewritten or tightened up on the fly, just as we're heading into a highly contested election year.
Interesting. I hear a common thread in all of the answers, all of your responses related to the courts.
Well, the courts are what forces things to happen. And you know, following along with what Bob said is the fact that on one hand, you have people like Michelle Reagan and Terry Goddard saying they're going to campaign on shining the light on dark money. We can't even enforce the laws we have now. Not only do we have the federal judge, but we have an Arizona case where a trial judge said that the laws that say you have to disclose for express advocacy are too vague mm-hmm. to be enforced. So that's also going to cause the rewrite that Bob was talking about. And I think that you have a lot of courts looking at the question of how far does the First Amendment extend? I mean, once the Supreme Court set the bar with Citizens United, I think there's going to be a lot of contention that we can anonymously, mm-hmm. Contribute to anything we want with maybe certain limits, and I'm saying mm-hmm. maybe.
Mm-hmm. What about looking at the candidates for governor? Do you think we've seen all the contenders at this point? And I'll count Scott Smith as a likely in there. That's the only. You think there's any chance of anybody else getting in?
Are you talking about the Brewer 2014 bumper stickers we're starting to see?
You've seen probably more of those than I have.
Look, she had an attorney who whispered in her ear and said, Jan, if you look at the law and squint just right, you can run again. And there's probably an argument to be made. You put three attorneys in a room, I'll give you six opinions. I've yet
to hear an attorney not in her employ.
Well,
say that,
I think A, that opinion is wrong. Sorry, Joe Canefield. And B, even if she were to run, that's assuming she could be nominated within her own party, given what happened with Medicaid.
And it probably was, however, a decent ploy to stave off lame duckery.
But it's unnecessary. She's got the veto pen. As long as she's got the veto pen, she's relevant.
Mm-hmm. So who's going to be the Republican candidate for governor? Rob?
You have to, at this early date, say that Doug Ducey is in a position, if he plays his cards right, to likely become a fairly formidable Republican frontrunner and perhaps make that primary more of a sleeper than anticipated. But he's still untested at that kind of a stage. And if he stumbles or somebody trips him up, then I think it's a complete free-for-all.
It was one of the more interesting things over the last several weeks as he danced around trying not to answer the question about whether or not he supported the governor's Medicaid expansion.
And I think he's playing for time. He understands that he will have to answer that question.
Well, I think he did, and he said he was against it. But I suspect privately to a lot of his business supporters, he was saying, I had to say that because I've got, the
well, and there's two questions about the Medicaid expansion. One is, was it a good idea? Was it the right policy for the state? I enthusiastically supported it for that reason. The second question is, was it lawfully enacted or did it mm-hmm. require a 2/3 vote? And that case is currently before
the courts.
Oh, my God, another legislative body doing things a little
bit. And I think the better argument is in favor of requiring the 2/3 vote. If that happens, I mean, that can provide kind of a safe haven for people like Doug Ducey, who wants to have it both ways, unless the courts throw out that 2/3 vote challenge.
And what's fascinating about the governor's argument on this, and you'll love this, I mean, I went to journalism, so I didn't have to deal with math, but this one even befuddles me. The argument by the governor is that a simple majority of the legislature can determine when you need a 2/3 vote. Well, then, at that point, you've effectively nullified what voters have mandated on a 2/3 vote. It makes no sense at
all. If the legislature is willing to assert itself on the first point.
Now, here's the tricky part about the case that we hope will be decided at the trial level any day is the question of whether the lawmakers who sued have standing to bring the case in the first mm-hmm. place. The governor's argument is the only people who can sue are the hospitals. Well, the hospitals aren't going to sue. They basically
were essentially bribed.
They were bribed because they're going to get more money in additional people covered mm-hmm. than they're paying in taxes. They're not going to sue. And in fact, they structured the damn thing in such a way that the hospitals that don't have a lot of indigent care would pay nothing. Mayo pays nothing. Phoenix Children's pays nothing. This thing was structured in a way to make sure the hospitals would sit on the sidelines.
And they make money out of the deal.
And they make money.
Which obviously explains the reason why the hospitals were behind this from the very beginning and funded very heavily all the efforts that were made to get, you know, to convince the Democrats to come on board and everything else.
So, Howie, who's our next governor?
The smart money would say Ducey, but I hate the smart money stuff. I am going to assume that if Al Melvin gets enough $5 donations to stay in the race, if a former
siphons off some votes,
if Andy Thomas siphons off some votes, I think both of them take from Ducey. I think that Ken Bennett is a safe bet. He's a known quantity, been in government a long time. Now the real unknown
in
this.
What about Scott Smith?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm not even sure that Scott's going to do it. You know, here it is, you know, early January, and as of the time we're taping this, we haven't heard from Scott. He may suddenly feel a draft, which may be coming from people standing next to him, you know, waving
fan. Usually comes from him.
The real unknown in this is Christine Jones, who talk about untested, and we don't know what she stands for, but as the lone woman in a race, presumably well-funded, an outsider. Now, what Ken has working against him is he's going to run with public money. That's $700,000 against perhaps $2 million that maybe Ducey can raise.
Fernanda, your take on this?
You know, I definitely agree that it's going to be a Republican. Fred Duval is an interesting character, but I just don't think that, you know, he has what it takes to become governor. I know very little about Doug Ducey, you know, like from a voter standpoint, which can be very helpful to him because people have very short-term memory.
He's got room to move.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll see how that plays out. I'm not going to risk a name, but if I were put a gun to my head, I'd say Doug Ducey.
Now, Bob, this all comes down to seating order. So you're actually batting third. Go ahead, finish up. We've got about 30 seconds.
I think there's a lot. As I said, I think it's Doug's to lose, the formidable front runner on the Republican side. If he loses it, I think it's a free-for-all and probably open between he, Bennett, and Scott Smith. And if it's a free-for-all on the Republican side, then that gives new hope for a Democratic candidate such as Fred Duval.
All right, Dr. Mike and I wrap it up when we come back. It's the news. It's the Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
And we want to thank Fernanda Santos of the New York Times. She's the Phoenix Bureau Chief. 2015, going to be a big year for her as her book about the Granite Mountain hotshots is to be published. Bob Robb was here from the Arizona Republic. And Howie Fisher from the Capital Times. Always good to have Howie here.
And our Triple Crown winner, remember
he
that?
He is the Triple Crown winner, a soothsayer.
Predictive genius.
He is. Now, Dr. O'Neill right here, MikeO'Neill.org for his blogs, articles, O'NeillResearch.com. That's his day job. You can check that out, too. Always good, fun stuff. I'm going to ask you the same questions that we asked our expert panel. I'm going to start local. What was the number one local story of 2013?
Oh, because of the dollars involved, the $1.2 billion.
With a B.
Which at the state level is big money. Not much at the federal, but at the state level, you get into billions. It's real dollars. For Medicaid expansion, I think, is the enduring impact study. I mean, I would not discount CPS. Certainly caught our attention, caught our heartstrings, as did Yarnell. But both of them are confined in terms of their impact.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, huge impact where they impact on the kids, on the people up in that area. But Medicaid is an enduring impact. It involves infusion of $1.2 billion into the state and has a huge impact on finances.
I think it left a lot of people nationwide. I think it left a lot of people their chin on the floor, seeing Governor Brewer back this, push this, support this. Caught a lot of people off guard.
I think that, she has a pragmatic side, and I think that same came, because if you look at what happened nationally, you look at the states that have adopted that and the states that haven't, they tended to follow a red and blue dichotomy. There was one thing, however, that made the arithmetic extremely different in Arizona.
and that is we had a voter paid initiative that raised up the bar for Medicaid coverage so that for Arizona, the incremental cost was very negligible mm-hmm. in comparison to other states. So it was a much more compelling case purely on the business side because the voters had already raised that bar and there was only a small increment necessary to take that further.
And there was some federal money involved there too, which chapped a lot of hides.
A lot of federal money.
Right.
But I'm saying the arithmetic was different for Arizona because the base in Arizona was already a lot higher and the amount of additional funds required in Arizona was so small that it could be done with a couple of fees tacked on to hospitals that were only too willing to pay for it. In other words, no statewide general funds were applied to do this, whereas in other states, while the feds were still paying the vast majority of this, they did have to come up with some money, which they did not in Arizona.
Now, I'll jump first. I'll combine the two because I think I have two of our top stories, one of our top stories here in the state, one of the top stories nationally that can blend together, and I'll show you how we do that. But what is your top national story of 2013?
I think it's the implementation of Obamacare. The president started, and a big negative for the president.
Sure.
In that, here's a guy, remember, in January of 2013, he's a guy who was just reelected to the presidency of the United States, and he's riding high. And now the actual implementation, particularly as we move towards the second half of the year, there's a lot of negative publicity. The website was a disaster, and he himself said was inexcusable. Now, what remains to be seen is in 2014, I think people's attitudes will be determined not by speculation about how this program will actually plan out, but by the reality of it, and we haven't seen that yet.
Right.
I mean, the first eligible participants, started getting health care this week, and they're going to have experiences, positive or negative. And people who've heard that this is going to be great or this is going to be terrible are going to have actual concrete personal experiences and will be making judgments based on that. And so the jury's out on the long-term thing, but there's no question in 2013 – the president took a bad hit. He started out riding high, and he ends up with approval ratings in the lower 40s. It's not historically the lowest ever, but it's on the low end. It's not a good place.
Right.
The question, my personal guess, by the way, is that in 2014 we see some rebound from that, not necessarily to the highest levels that he reached. There's a statistical phenomenon known as regression towards the mean, which means if you're very low or very high, you tend to get moved back towards
the
center.
All right, stop using your college words here. All right, but I will tell you that Howie and Fernanda brought up the NSA.
Yep.
And I think that that Bob brought up Obamacare as well. He was talking more of he's talking about power more than he was talking about anything else. But I want to talk about the NSA because I will tell you, it's my opinion. If Obamacare became the greatest thing, sliced bread here, mm-hmm. Obamacare here, if it became the great thing, if nothing changes with the NSA, I don't think the president's approval rating takes that big of a jump. The NSA is an anchor right now, I think, as it just seems a death by a thousand cuts.
By the way, every day
something new is coming out. We learn more and more about intercepting laptops this week. Come on!
This was a hard call. I wouldn't discount that one as a huge issue. But it's an interesting one, particularly in terms of the Republican side of this, because you have the libertarian Republicans like yourself
right.
who are just outraged by this. And you have this other group, which is, I think, probably larger in the Republican Party, which is the National Security
group. Al-Qaeda, 9/11.
Who
don't
basically
forget.
Are...
Terrorists are coming for you.
Who would give up liberty for security. I mean, it's
sure.
a fight between liberty and security. And
amen.
I think, and most people, really, it depends how much liberty and how much security. You know, right after 9/11, I think the consensus was willing to give up a whole lot. We've had 10 years of relative security, and that needle, I think, has moved a little bit.
I think we had 10 years prior to as well. We took one event and we spent trillions of dollars and stripped a lot of people of liberty. I think, I understand the Patriot Act. Well, the problem with the Republican Party now, the problem that Republicans face, Obama's signature is not on the Patriot Act.
Right.
Whose signature's on that? Right. W signature's
on that. And I think some of what, and you see this in Obama in defense, is there was a period of a number of years where Democrats were perceived as weak on defense. I think that happened up till really the Clinton era. And I think Obama said, listen, I am not going to give that one up. Mm-hmm. And so when defense comes to me, or when the NSA people come to me with stuff they're all, I do not want to, if I cut something back and then there was some terrorist attack, the pro-national security Republicans would be all over me. And I think he decided, I think against his own, you know, he's a, as a constitutional lawyer, so, he is somebody that you would expect to be kind of on the more restrictive side on that. And in practice, he has not been.
Let's go to Bob's point. Let's go to Bob's point about the separation of powers and Obama using presidential authority. He did say it can't be challenged in the court yet. The
ACLU. Are you talking in the context of NSA or
the context
or
of the NSA and Obamacare? Yep. He has not been challenged in the court. Here's why. This is my theory. Remember, we had the head of the ACLU on this very show, the Arizona ACLU. ACLU. Thank you. And she mentioned that you have to show that someone was impacted. Somebody was impacted negatively to get this to the Supremes where it needs to be.
Yep.
In the case of Obamacare, you can't really. We can see it that the administration is using its power, some would say illegally, but definitely not constitutionally. But no one's been impacted or affected by that just yet.
In the case of Obamacare, I think they've had that bite at the apple. They took this all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court passed.
I'm talking about
it.
The fixes. I'm talking about the Obamacare fixes.
Yeah.
The snaking that we're doing, and when I say snake, I mean the serpentine we're doing in and out of different laws to make it fixed.
Well, I was surprised at some of Bob's comment. It really gets to detailed of a 2,000-year law or 2,000-page law. There's always a lot of stuff that there is administrative discretion on implementation, and I can't tell you that I know how far or whether that's been exceeded. If it clearly has, my guess is there's no shortage of people who would love to take that to court.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so let's do years. Your prediction moving ahead to 2014.
2014, from a legislative, I will say this: if you look at history in terms of, say, congressional votes, the Republicans ought to retake the Senate. If you look at historical trends, and they ought to gain in the House. The only thing that I think can beat them is themselves.
Amen.
In the last couple of years, they have lost several Senate races each go-round that they clearly should have run, frankly, by nominating somewhat kooky candidates. And they appear to have the capacity to do that. This will be it's the most interesting fight within politics, which is the pragmatist on the Republican side who'd like to win elections and the purist who want to be right on everything and who really believe that that's the way to win elections.
I think that the implementation of Obamacare and a lot of the young people in this country that the Democrats have leaned on for a long time are realizing that, wait, this costs me money and the NSA. I think you're not going to have young Democrat voters move to the Republican side. I can almost assure you that's not going to happen. What you might have is them stepping on the sidelines for this vote, which helps the Republicans.
That's the usual risk. You don't have too much flipping from one side to the other, but you have people, the enthusiasm gap potentially goes down. But I'll tell you one thing that's interesting. I've seen some very, very fascinating charts talking about the voting patterns by age groups. And we tend to keep those political dispositions that we come of age with.
Sure.
And so the youngest group is Democratic. Reagan era young people were Republican. The baby boomers were mixed. You get into the oldest demographic. They're the FDR Democrats. You tend to keep the political dispositions that you start out with.
He is Dr. Mike O'Neill. I am Mike Russell. This is The Think Tank. Fernanda Santos, Bob Robb, Howie Fisher, thanks so much. It's been a great look at 2013. Here's to a great 2014. Happy New Year, everyone. This is The Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.